Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Again.
It is again.
It's again. It's not like just 10 minutes ago we were arguing about homelessness. It's definitely a whole different day.
Let's go back to This Life. All right. So our guest today is Zach Scow.
This is going to be a breath of fresh air.
Yes,
thank God.
Exactly.
Something beautiful, something great, something good.
No
something...
pressure, guys.
Well, the dog pack is what we want to talk about. But tell people your story first.
It's Zach.
Yeah, well, I was diagnosed with end-stage liver disease in 2008.
Alcoholic liver disease?
Mm-hmm. I drank myself and drug myself into liver failure at 28. I'm still currently a transplant patient at Cedars-Sinai.
Did you have hep C too?
No.
No, just straight alcoholic liver disease.
Acute alcoholic hepatitis. I did it right.
Wow,
it's called
acute.
You get pancreatitis too?
No. You don't get
I had pancreatitis.
That's a separate thing. Yeah. You get, this is called acute sclerosing hyaline necrosis.
Yeah.
Did you get kidney failure on top of it?
Kidney failure.
There you go.
That's the full deal. And I am one of 0.5% of liver patients who are able to reverse their cirrhosis of the liver. So I go in for testing. I have
I'm confused. You had a transplant?
No, I did.
Did not need a transplant.
Once you're end stage and you kind of get admitted into a comprehensive program, end stage sounds like it sounds. You either die or you get a transplant usually, you know, and it's also for people with kidney issues.
Well, acute sclerosing hyaline necrosis is a funny thing. It's considered the progenitor of cirrhosis. It's just coming. Here it comes.
Yeah.
But somehow you got in the way of it. How did they do that?
Well,
other than stopping drinking.
It was pretty remarkable. You know,
I
was
sober.
Sobriety was the catalyst. I mean, when I got out of the hospital, I spent 2 months in the hospital, and the instructions were you need 6 months sober in order to qualify for a transplant, and you're not going to survive 6 months. They gave me, you know, basically you can plug in your numbers to the Mayo Clinic website. They gave me I didn't have a chance of reaching 90 days without a transplant. I was going to die.
What he had was called the hepatorenal syndrome. And once you get the hepatorenal syndrome, you're on your way.
I was 140 pounds. I was bright yellow. I had a 9 months pregnant, so swollen.
Portal hypertension, hepatorenal syndrome,
exactly.
The whole deal.
Yeah, exactly. And they're draining me every 3 days.
You know, it means putting a giant, like, 3-gauge needle into his abdomen.
Exactly.
And what looks like urine pouring out of his side.
And then they sit
liters and
of...
liters and liters and
oh,
liters.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
they plop
That's
in
just
front
to make
of
him comfortable.
And they say, this is what you've done to yourself. You know what I mean? So I went through all that. I mean,
shaming medicine. There you go.
No, it's to keep him comfortable. It's to make him feel better.
Yeah. No, but to make him... This is what you did to yourself?
Yeah. Well he thought that. No one said that to you, did they?
You know, there was a little bit of trying to get me to understand what I was going through.
They were
trying to let you know. Yeah. And there was a cultural difference here.
This is not a joke.
Pakistani and Indian doctors were my doctors. They're some of my closest friends to this day. But culturally, they're not looking at it as much as from an alcoholic standpoint, at least 10 years ago.
They were looking at strictly medical.
Strictly medical. Yeah. So I was sent home to try
and
survive.
Did you educate them?
We have since, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, well, Dr. Dalal, Dr. Aziz,
well done.
Dr. Manu, if you're out there, these are some of my closest friends.
Yeah.
And they really have made a transition into more of an understanding of the culture of alcoholism and drug addiction.
Well,
the
brain disease.
exactly.
But then you found your passion.
Yeah. Well, I'd been working in dogs to try and... Because I was sick for a long time. I was drinking 24 hours a day. That was what my life was about.
Dog was your only friend?
Well, dogs were the only way I could put on the front, you know, that I have a twin brother, and he was, at that point, he'd gotten a master's degree, and all these successful people around me. So I could say, you're... getting your master's degree and successful in whatever work you're doing. I happen to be working for the Humane Society. Cue the slow clap, and I can keep it going,
yeah.
Keep my friends up the illusion that I was doing something redeeming. When inside I had an absolute, crisis of, I couldn't stand myself. I couldn't stand to look myself in the mirror. And working with dogs was the only thing that kind of helped me feel redeemable.
Hmm.
When I got sent home, the doctor said, it was terminal. They wanted to send me on hospice care. It was just have them comfortable.
This is crazy. And, have you written a book about this?
No.
You should write a book.
Let's work on it. Well, I brought my 24-hour day book from my grandfather, which we'll talk about, which is very, one of those God shots that happened to me that sent me in the right direction. But actually, we can talk about it now.
When I got home,
home from the hospital. My job was, I wasn't healthy enough to take transplant. I didn't qualify for one. So I wanted to kill myself when I got home. All I thought about was fantasizing about what my dad
did. Did you drink when you got home?
I didn't right away, no. My dad stayed with me 24 hours a day for the first month. I had my first meeting in the hospital. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me. A guy that had gotten through liver failure in prison showed up at the foot of my hospital bed. And basically, that was my first, you know, introduction into the program. And I never forgot it. And he's still my Eskimo. He'd killed someone in a drunk driving accident, served 9 years in prison. And that was my first introduction to the program. And I've never left. But this, I didn't know anything about the program except that I'd been with friends when I was in high school and college. For them, right, as moral support. I was very suicidal when I got back. That's really all I thought about. You know, at the time I was so ill. I had no idea how to live without drugs and alcohol. And my dad's dad died of liver failure, the exact disease that I have, in 1961.
Wow, that's the year I was born.
So I'm going through his things. I find these letters that he's writing from an AA house in Bellflower. I find this book, which is a 24-hour day, but I know exactly what it was when I saw it because I've been going to meetings
for
a month.
That's a soft cover.
So I open it, and my dad's always told me stories about his dad. Never much, just that he was a terrible individual. He died when he was 15, that he didn't cry when he found out he died. Terrible stories, really just an awful relationship, if any relationship at all. I find this book, bring it into the room. I set it down with my dad and start flicking through it. It's got his social security card in it. Kermit Alden Scow is his name. I'd never heard his full name. And it's marked. You can see the ribbon. It's marked.
Right.
So I hand it to my dad. He starts to weep. And my dad doesn't, you know, he's not a big crier. He cries now, but not for these type of reasons. And he goes, "I'll be damned. I'll be damned." And he says, "It's marked." And I go, "Well, what's it marked?" He says, "July 3rd. I said, "Well, what's July 3rd? He goes, "That's the day the bastard died." So he was reading his 24-hour day book the day he died of liver failure at 41 years of age when my dad was 15. And there's a piece of paper in it that you know, has this information on it, and I brought it to
his
my sponsor.
Information?
It has his sponsor's name, who's Friedman, his phone number, and it has the phone number for the men's Cadillac meeting on the men's stag meeting on Cadillac Street Saturday night in downtown Los Angeles.
Wow.
So I didn't know what it meant. I gave it to my sponsor. He told me what it meant. So I got this gem. I got this thing. This, you know, and at the time I'm searching for what a God of my understanding is.
I'm already sort of amazed that you had a sponsor and you were going to meetings regularly. That's sort of extraordinary.
But
it sounds like he was doing it on a sort of self-motivated.
Part of the liver transplant program is you have to fax them proof that you're going to meetings.
So you're motivated to get a liver.
Dr. Tram Tran, she's a woman, wonderful woman. Shout out to Dr. Tram. She was the head of transplant at the time. I had to fax her proof that I was going to meetings. So the first time I went to a meeting, I was on a liver card. I was, instead of a cork card, I was on a liver card. And so the first meeting I went to was, the address was a bar. And we walk into this place, I'm going, what is this? They just throw you right into it, don't they? Yeah. And there's a bunch of old guys sitting at a booth. And I go, oh my God, this is what it is. This is so weird. I can't walk at the time. I got ammonia on my brain. And finally, we go sit down with these old men. They're like, "You're out of your minds." The meeting hall is behind the parking lot. You're in the wrong spot. And then my focus from that point on was just, I need to talk to the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need a liver transplant.
Well, there's a lot of them. You could meet a lot of them.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
So wait, this is funny. Keep going.
Yeah, so
the president of Alcoholics Anonymous.
They try to explain to me. You know what it's like, Dr. Drew, with ammonia.
I want to talk to the head guy.
Yeah.
So when your liver doesn't work, you can't break down the nitrogenous waste coming out of your gut, so you accumulate ammonia throughout your system. And the manifestations can be wild and bizarre.
Yeah, you don't know what day it is sometimes.
Yeah, and then you're also a grandiose alcoholic.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You're also way in your disease.
Yeah.
And here we go. Head.
So so I'm going to show everyone, now that I have a few days of sobriety, like what I'm truly made of. I'm going to become the president.
This sounds more like what I was expecting. the weeping over the book. I'm like, what? Huh? A sponsor? What?
Well, you know.
Now makes sense.
I was so, you know, and I didn't really get the meetings. I just knew that I needed that. They were means to an end.
Yeah,
I needed them to get my liver transplant.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so then finally they go, "We have a secretary." I was like, "Bingo, let me have him.
Let me
bring me to the secretary."
Guy.
And I'm raising my hand
to make comments.
Yeah, because
I want to give some feedback.
Yeah, I'm trying to be polite.
You know? They're like, Jesus, the bright orange guy looks pregnant.
I was so to give you context. I wore my shades everywhere because I was humiliated about how yellow my eyes were. Yeah. I had duct tape. My belly button was herniated. So I had duct tape my. It looked like I had a little boner sticking through my shirt.
Yeah.
So I duct taped my belly button down so that you couldn't see it. I always wore baggy clothes, long sleeve shirts. I would tan my ass off so that you couldn't see the jaundice. That's how I because I kept it going for as long as possible. Uh-huh. As long as possible. The only reason I got checked into the hospital for a long stay was because I started leaking blood from both ends. You know, is the only reason that we got.
It's a good reason to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
So just you know what that means. Let me just describe what happens here. First of all, your liver can't even make the clotting factors anymore that makes your blood clot. So your proton goes off the chain. And because of the same thing that accumulates the fluid in the abdomen, also accumulates blood behind the liver. So you get varicose veins in your ass and in your esophagus.
Yep.
And you can't clot them, so they just bleed.
So several of my sponsees who I've sponsored in liver failure they've passed away through. And this is a very real. This is the underbelly of liver failure. Esophageal varices bleed. You bleed out orally, and I've seen it happen in the ICU twice.
It's like a fountain. You've never seen anything like
they
it.
They cauterize them
it's
if they
blood
can.
Blood everywhere.
It is Woo. Very, very, and it smells like you wouldn't believe. Yeah. You know, and it's a very real product of what happens when we are.
So you have to transfuse them. You have to transfuse them with the clotting factors.
Frozen plasma.
Those only last a little while, and hope you can get in there and cauterize.
Freezing cold plasma transfusions all the time.
See, and here's the thing, and I'm sure you've been a part of this now. The kids that are dying nowadays are nowhere near that stage of the disease of alcoholism. They don't even know you're from Mars, right? And my story is similar to yours. And it's hard to communicate with them. You deal with newcomers all the time. They've been using heroin for a year. They're going to be dead tonight, maybe this weekend. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they don't relate to people like you and me because our stories are so graphic and so
medical,
down and dirty and they don't understand it and they've never lived like that. So I've started to kind of tame down my story and make it more about feelings and more about suicide.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Said you wanted to commit suicide. I wanted to commit suicide every day that last year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the kids relate to suicide more than they relate to bleeding out your ass, Drew.
Yes,
it's weird.
That makes sense
to me.
Well,
the incomprehensible demoralization is something I think I lived for so long that I didn't remember what it was like to not be that way.
But it's a really, really interesting point you're raising, Bob, which is...
They don't relate to incomprehensible.
There's a generation...
I can't even say it now. I've gotten it out of my vocabulary.
Because addictions become sanitized and medically carried out.
Yeah.
Weird.
I completely agree. Yeah. It is different to.
But they would love the dogs. They will gravitate towards you because of the dogs.
Yes.
Oh, big time.
And you could save them from a death of fentanyl.
Mm-hmm.
Not with your story that helps people like me and that's helped. Alcoholics have helped each other for 100 years by telling our story, but just by talking about the dogs.
Yeah,
weird.
Absolutely.
It's so weird, but true.
It also creates an automatic vulnerability that it's
the dogs do?
Absolutely. Yeah. Far more effective than having a psychiatrist or a therapist.
We'll talk about the dogs.
Yeah.
Tell us.
Well, I mean, the dogs were – I had – my real moment was standing in front of the mirror. I relapsed a month afterwards. So my dad went to Brazil for 48 hours. I found a way to find backup keys to the car. It was just to taste it. I hadn't slept. It was one of those things – you know, I don't have to explain to you guys.
I love it. I love it. Here's what it is. I just need a sip. Just one more sip. Last sip and then I'm done.
Because surely I can't – I won't drink like an alcoholic because I'm this way already.
I'm already intoxicated.
I'm regulated. I'm in liver failure. Certainly I'll regulate
myself. A little schnapps. A little peppermint schnapps fresh in your breath.
Yeah, and I blacked out for 2 days. I don't remember any of it. And
did you end up back in the hospital?
My dad came back from Brazil. I had to walk over and I told him, hey – we have to go to the hospital, and he didn't believe me. I took off my glasses. He saw the yellow in my eyes, and I said, listen, I drank again. My stomach's filled, and we need to go to the hospital now. And he just started to weep. He started to weep, and he said, I've always been afraid of it, but I know how you're going to kill yourself, and it's happening right now. And he just kept saying, you've killed yourself, you've killed yourself, you've killed yourself. And, you know, he reluctantly took me to the hospital. And that was the last
reluctantly.
Time I drank. He was, at that point, he was so dejected.
He
was so
given up.
Jaded.
You're just dead. That's it. Why bother?
Yeah. He was.
I think eventually, all will flee from the alcoholic.
Yeah. Yeah. And what happened was,
Jesus, you haven't quoted the big book in a long time.
My dogs were.
still know it pretty well.
I could use some big book quoting, actually, man. That's getting back to it. That's so nostalgic. I love it, man. Yeah. If I could, I'd have probably 10 things magnetized.
I had a similar
fridge.
Thing. So I always depended on two. My parents, I wasn't involved with, but I had friends, good friends I grew up with in the LA music community. And these two friends I'd always use to like go by their house, bullshit them, steal from them, take a shower, get something to eat, sleep on the couch, get some girls' phone numbers, just like regroup. I always use their house to regroup. But I knew not to go there more than like once every 6 weeks for like 2 or 3 days, depending. And so I go by there, and their house is empty. All the furniture's gone, you know? And I was like,
they were
what?
Fleeing
and,
you.
And this is back in the payphone days, right? This is back in the payphone days. So I called their payphone, their home phone. It went to voicemail. So I called a mutual friend. I said, where did Louis and Keith move to? I'm at their house. They're not there. And he goes, I don't want to get involved.
My dad, he wishes he could have erected a boundary like that. You know what I mean?
So then finally the guy I called says, they don't want you to know where they've moved to.
I have friends.
That had a profound effect on me.
Bob, you should know I have friends to this day that you used to go visit. You'd pound on their door and they'd pretend they weren't home.
Yeah, they pretend. I had a go around, but it's similar to family if you had your dad and your brother. And you had this love of dogs that led to you and I doing Celebrity Rehab about 7 years ago, and we were trying to promote your organization, and then a client had a seizure in the middle of your episode, and the Mutt Militia got kind of lost promo and the editing.
Yeah, I understand.
So really what I've discovered over the years and what happened for me in that moment was dogs are absolute medicine. Medicine in terms of therapy, medicine in terms of motivation, medicine in terms of living examples for how to deal with trauma. Almost all the dog I operate a dog rescue called Marley's Mutt's Dog Rescue. We've been around essentially since I was in liver failure. I started it in the middle of liver failure as just a way to get out of my head. I needed to be of service to something other than, you know.
Was it always traumatized dogs, or was it just abandoned dogs?
These are all shelter dogs. So some of them.
But you have an amputee dog with you today.
Yeah, I have a double amputee. With me today, named Cora Rose, and she's just she's the happiest dog on planet Earth. And,
I know, I noticed that.
And the struggle we went through just to explain to people that she has a high quality of life was remarkable. People still don't believe that she can have a high quality of life, and so dogs have served in that capacity in my life. They're always right there to show me the way. They really have been. And whether it's unconditional love, whether it was coming out of opiate withdrawal,
you can tell us about that.
Well, when I got addicted to Dilaudid in the hospital,
the
pain, the way hospitals deal with pain, you're in liver failure, is this, the smiley chart. And so if you deal with a drug addict and you tell him, point at the frowny, there's a smiley face, a straight face, and a frowny face.
He's referring to the pain scale God has been removed from
but
all
this was, you were there during the whole, what brought us the pain, the opiate epidemic.
10 years
absolutely.
Ago.
Absolutely.
Ten years ago?
I got heavily
think
addicted.
About it. They gave a alcoholic
But your liver
drug
bounced back, I'll bet.
Well, it got much, much worse in the hospital. My liver did, yeah. Much worse. It wasn't until I got admitted to comprehensive transplant at Cedars and Dr. Tran took me off everything. She took me off 10 of the 12 medications I was on.
Good.
And that's when things started to get better. Mm. But when I went through withdrawal, they sent me home. You know, I had no idea what was about to happen.
You got liver failure and opiate withdrawal?
Yeah.
You're still alive?
I was getting Dilaudid every 4 hours for 5 weeks.
Well, to be fair, the ammonia will... It's like taking
Xanax. Oh, my God. He's going to say it's a good thing that Dilaudid and the ammonia.
No, no. I'm saying for the withdrawal. The withdrawal.
Oh,
for
sure. Cover. You won't know that you're in withdrawal.
Right. Exactly. It's so out of it. But it could have been a disaster. It could have been just total disaster.
Look at this guy. Look at this guy. No front legs. He's got a little car, but he jumps around on the ground.
Yeah, she walks on her back.
She walks around.
Yeah. So, you know, the opiate withdrawal, when my dogs were present, it was the only thing that kept me from losing my mind. They grounded me. They brought me some kind of understanding that things were going to be okay. Because I was losing my mind. Full auditory, visual hallucinations. I mean, I saw devils in the ceiling. I thought I was dying, you know. And I had all three of my dogs with me. And I had lost control of my bowels, which is just a regular part of liver failure. Mm-hmm. And I walk into the
bathroom. Well, they're also giving you meds to give you diarrhea.
Oh, lactulose and annulose, the worst drugs on planet Earth. Yeah. So I'm standing in front of the mirror, and I don't recognize who I'm looking at, you know? I got this little old man, yellow butt with wrinkles. I'm only 29 now at this point. I do not recognize who I'm looking at in the mirror. So I'm start to cry, and I kind of look behind me. I feel my dog's presence, and they're all looking up at me like, you know, just wagging their tails. Elated,
nothing's changed around here.
Looking at me like I'm spiritually the Dalai Lama and physically Brad Pitt. I mean, I am just the God's gift to human beings. And better than that, it was that they knew I was in there, man. They knew I was in there. And that's what I needed. I needed someone to let me know, like, hey, we recognize your spirit. We recognize your beautiful soul. Because I felt worse than I know how to describe feeling inside. You know, I absolutely hated myself, every part of my being, and I didn't know how to live. And I got these creatures, these conscious creatures that I very much respect, looking at me, knowing, recognizing that light is still in there. You know, and that was the next day that we started journaling the next day, and I started walking them.
We
meaning me and the dogs.
You journaled with – tell me more about that, because you were speaking a language there that caught my attention, and then it sort of paid out in the we.
I can't talk I that much anymore. I have to talk we, and it's always me and the dogs.
But you and I believe that
there's other people involved with you. You got a guy with you. You've got a community of support.
But of course, but it is connectedness that we believe gets people through and around.
Absolutely. Man.
And it's the first time I've heard a connection to a dog story that really seemed to be at the center of it.
It was all of it, man. It was connecting to my dogs, and it was connecting to my grandfather who passed from liver failure. So in the program, you get the gift of developing your own a God of your understanding. I needed to find that God. I'm an atheist. How am I supposed to do that? And that day, that interaction with my dogs gave me the permission to, I started literally looking up at the night sky and picturing my grandfather's face. I found a bunch of these pictures. I started talking to him. Never met the guy. He died when my dad was 15, but I developed a beautiful relationship with a God of my understanding that involved him. It involved my dogs. It involved nature. It involved people and meetings.
This is an important story for people to hear.
And I threw myself into, like, how beautiful of a thing is that? That you get – there's no dogma hanging over my head. There's the steps and the traditions, which I don't mind – which I love being a part of. And I don't mind using that as a guideline. But there wasn't any punishment. There wasn't – I had this complete freedom to find a God of my understanding. And I think I was just thrilled about that. I was thrilled to have to be granted the grace to do that. And so that's what my dogs and I set out to do, is like, let's go figure it out. Let's just go figure it out one step at a time, literally.
And where were you living when this happened? In West Side LA?
In my dad's garage in Tehachapi.
Oh,
so I'm living 2 hours north of LA. We're having to go to Cedars every 2 days. Living in a garage and one in the house and just started bringing dogs into my pack. We started walking every single day to get the ammonia off, to get the all this bile and blood, and I had to keep moving. So I couldn't get very far at first, just down the driveway. But that's all we did was we walked, we went to meetings, we put one foot in front of the other, literally. And I started to notice things, and I started to be able to take in beauty. I started to be able, you know, in many ways, addiction is a crisis of self-esteem. I lost my self-esteem through a series of trauma in my life. You know, I'm a childhood sexual abuse survivor from a family member, something I didn't even realize played into my life the way it did until I got into the program, until I allowed myself therapy. And then the power went away from it. It wasn't something that I'm saddled with. I don't constantly think of myself as a victim of sexual abuse. I'm just elated that I figured it out.
Right. Well, not just figured it out, but you reconnected with that part of yourself that was hidden back, traumatized.
I keep thinking I have to fix myself. Yeah. I just need to get back to get back to that kid.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all. And that's so much easier,
which you were disconnected from.
Exactly.
Again, another kind of connection.
Uh-huh.
I always used to scream at, you know, connect to others, connect to self, connect to others, connect to self.
Yeah.
This is a great story about that.
Yeah, man. And so the dogs, you know, the dogs also helped me get out of my comfort zone. What sobriety is all about is, you know, for me anyway, I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of, like, the market, the grocery store was, like, terrifying. I couldn't drive sober. I hadn't driven sober in years. So people get close to me. I didn't know how to do these things. I was afraid of all of it, especially interactions. But if I had a dog with me, it always made these interactions easier. It took the pressure off of me directly. We could talk about the dog. We could talk about something else. And that's God, that took the pressure off, man. Because I would get into bullshitting. I would find, especially in the beginning, I would start to lie to. I have a pretty remarkable story. I don't need to lie about anything. I would start to. You know how it is. You go, and then the shame starts again. The cycle of shame because you're fibbing for no reason. You know, and so the dogs just allowed me to have conversations. Oh,
these are all such great examples of how addiction works. Yeah. It's so perfect. Yeah. Right? I mean, everyone does that. Yeah. Has the disease.
Absolutely, man.
And so the dogs became a mission, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we live in Kern County, and millions of dogs are being euthanized in shelters, you know. And I found these little furry balls of medicine that could help me. And I started doing the speaking circuit. I started going to different places in Malibu. My mom.
As a speaker or as a.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mom hit rock bottom in the middle of that. So
oh my God.
I brought her. She's almost 7 years sober now.
Oh my God.
Worked at the. She tried to drive off a bridge, you know, tried to. Commit suicide a couple of times. Oh, she's boy. Now almost 7 years sober. She's been working at the rescue mission in Bakersfield, California, being of service to others for seven years. And what I found with the dogs is just like we've just scratched the surface. It's like, you know, space flight or something. There's this whole frontier out there. And it gets a little murky because we're dealing with so many people that are blurring the lines with like emotional support dogs. But dogs have that capacity in across so many avenues of life, you know, whether it's helping people open up, whether it's helping people get out of their comfort zone. What we use them for primarily is in prison. So we operate four dog programs in California
State. You have a juvenile program too, right?
We do, yeah. We have.
So tell us about the whole gambit of.
Well, I've been trying to get into prison for years and years for the exact, to just share what I found. Which is a whole new life. You know, I have this whole new life because of my dogs. And it was
is there a pilot program going on? Because if you were in Tehachapi, that's got a pretty good prison there.
Yeah, so we start in Tehachapi next month. We're at California City State Prison. We've been there for almost 3 years.
Oh, okay.
We've been at Corcoran State Prison, level 4,
oh,
old Corcoran.
That's serious.
Yeah, that was the gnarliest of gnarly prisons. And we brought down the violence rate. We brought gangs that haven't talked to each other in probably the history of prisons together, and we're teaching we're teaching these guys emotional skills and actual skills. A lot of people don't think if you've ever taken your dog to a dog border or if you've ever needed training, there is a paradigm is shifting where we treat our animals like kids. So there's a ton of money being put into this work. So we're training our inmates.
Oh,
to have
no,
a
we
very
spend more money on our
viable.
Dogs than we do our children at this point.
But this is work they can do.
So yeah, seven
jobs
guys
when they
yeah,
get out.
Yeah.
Seven guys have gotten out of prison. Guess what? All seven of them are professional dog trainers.
Wow. There you go.
One of them was on the FBI's most wanted list. He was in jail for murder. The other served 19 years in prison. These are black men. These are Asian men. These are white men. These are guys of every background, every reason why they shouldn't be in a female women dominated profession, but they are kicking ass and they've practiced on it for 3 years in prison with they live with these dogs. These dogs live there for 3 months.
So the dogs are allowed in the prisons.
They live there, yeah.
Wow.
These are dogs come straight from the shelter.
God, they're trying anything to get to that's pretty innovative.
I'm just thinking,
when
how did you
think
get them to do that?
Corcoran State Prison.
Did you have to go
dog.
To the warden and figure that out?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It took us 4 years.
I bet. Yeah. Hey, let's take a little break and we'll hear more about that.
Exciting.
One of the most crucial components of addiction recovery is accountability. Part of what makes addiction so difficult is the inability to self-regulate. Now, this is especially problematic for those in outpatient recovery or pain management program. And while the facilities require regular urine tests to ensure compliance, frequently the actual tests are not even observed. And this led to an epidemic of falsified samples where patients either use someone else's urine or widely available synthetic urine. The result is a lot of addicts carry right on using undetected, and they get none of the benefits from treatment. The only objective test we have for addiction is the urine screen. Now, recently, I learned about a new solution that virtually eliminates the possibility of faking tests, even in facilities where they are unobserved. This is called ToxProtect, a DNA-verified drug test and lab service that provides 100% sample authenticity. ToxProtect was created by Genetox Labs, can be used in place of any standard urine drug test. It starts with simple one-time cheek swab to establish the patient's identity. Once submitted, each subsequent screening uses DNA testing to verify that that sample matches the patient. And additionally, ToxProtect screens for synthetic urine and irregular values that would indicate dilution or other adulteration. In other words, this pretty much guarantees accountability. I'm excited to see this service being used, and I think it will significantly improve an addict's chances for successful recovery.
I'm going to be talking more about Genetox Labs and Tox Protect on future shows. Thankfully, Tox Protect is being used by more and more facilities every day. Be sure to ask for it by name wherever you or your loved one is receiving care. To get more information or share it with your facilities, go to drdrew.com/toxprotect. That is drdrew.com/toxprotect.
Drew, don't you have some other ads to read?
Well, I want to talk about Tox Protect for a second because this is one of the things that really has bothered me, that people were not doing observed urines. Lots of programs weren't doing that. Lots of researchers.
But they have cups that you can't cheat.
Well, now with the Genetox, they check your DNA in your cheek, and the DNA's got to match the urine. It's perfect.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. Yes. That's what I'm supporting these guys.
How much does that cost?
It's not that expensive. So check it out. If you want to check it out for your programs.
Yeah. For outpatient, for sure.
Remind everybody to go to doctor.com, check our weekly opium series newsletter. We've got a whole dialogue there going about how the opiate crisis developed. And, you know, you've heard an example of it today here with Zach in terms of how he was pushed medicines. We'll tell you exactly how that happened. And we're going to do a narcissism series about why we're so tribal, why we're so black and white in our thinking, right?
Right.
So have we ever talked about this?
What?
We should do it about the narcissistic turn and how it's affecting how
I've just always
behaving.
Been narcissistic, so it's yeah, just been no turn for me.
we'll talk about that.
It has lightened over time in therapy.
Yours, right. My thing is narcissism is not a pejorative strictly. It's actually an asset in certain situations, but it has a liability that we're deeply into right now. Heal.com, don't forget those guys. They will come right to you, $90 all in, or your insurance if you got it. Keep going.
But I'm interested in that DNA thing. So for outpatient, that will tell you that the urine, if they just go in a bathroom and they pee in a cup supposedly by themselves.
Who knows?
If they don't, the DNA will match the pee to the person.
Yeah.
Oh, so there's no cheating.
You can't cheat.
Now, what do we know about drug tests? When you tell the patient, you can't fucking cheat this. See this strip? It has the DNA of your urine and the DNA of your mouth, and if it doesn't match, you're lying. Is there anything you'd like to say to me right now?
Yeah.
That's what we used to do when we had a rehab together.
Yeah.
You really, because you need the patient to tell the truth. That's more important than the fucking grub test.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Right? And so when you've got it in your hand, and the newest ones that I had were cups, right? I said, you know this cup? And I lie sometimes and tell them that it's the expensive cup and it's not. That cup will turn a certain color if it's really, you know, your urine. But if you're trying to put a bag of urine in there, some, you know, we had a client who had a penis made. Yeah. How about that? He made a fake penis so that he would, even if it was observed, urine would come out of it.
I'm envious I didn't come up with it.
Bob, there was enough demand for that. It's called the Wizinator. They actually can get those online.
There was Tom Sizemore was our client. Tom Sizemore watched the movie Boogie Nights. He tells the story much better than me, and he went, that's what I need, because he knew that Wahlberg's penis wasn't that big, so he knew there was a guy that had made a penis for the end scene of Boogie Nights, and he got in contact with the guy and he got him to make him one.
Tom's a
and
genius.
Then it had fake pee in the side of it.
Absolutely brilliant.
Wizinator.
Yeah, so anyway,
and they have different shades to match your skin.
Oh my God!
I swear to God.
Of course they do.
Yes, course.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I'm gonna look it up.
Oh my God!
Oddly enough, on the subject of, I think all dog toys and penis like toys are made at the same factory. They are so incredibly similar. I have some dog toys, especially for large dogs. I'm looking at this thing going, this is nothing but a large
different mold in the same factory.
Wrong. Yeah,
it looks like a bone instead of something else. So it was sad because we were trying to promote. We chose certain organizations to promote on Celebrity Rehab at the outings because Drew didn't really like going on the outings.
Ugh.
I didn't mind it because I didn't. That meant I didn't have to go to the rehab shooting. I could just meet at the park where I didn't mind.
Yeah.
So yours got messed up. We had heard about your organization, I think, from Patty Schimmel. What's the drummer from Hole?
Yeah.
She has a dog organization.
Schimmel.
I think Schimmel. That's how we heard about you. Yes. And so we were going to try to promote you. And then somebody had a seizure on the show and that got all lost your mission. Yeah. And I'm sorry. So now we're going to, want to promote your organization.
There's the
Wizinator. He's showing me the fake penises online.
But look where the bladder for your urine on right goes with it. That's the length addicts go. This is the stuff.
Is it like real handsome? Am I getting envious over here?
It's an envious penis.
Am I going to be on Resonator.com later?
Oh my god, there's black and there's
yeah, that's a great display.
Wow. With all, and you notice there's a whole thing
stream
for the
that
for
on
why
Facebook
do you have
live.
To be packing heat while you do a drug test?
Oh, they have different sizes.
You know?
But they figure in what this one.
Yeah, they figure. Yeah, you probably load in your height and weight.
You might as well
and
live
they
your
determine
dream.
It.
You know? Right. Who hasn't wanted a new penis, right?
But so you've been on this mission, and that was probably 7 years ago that you were going to be on the show.
I've been holding
a
resentment ever since.
I'm sorry. So you were only 3 years sober. You were only 3 years away from death's door, and you seem fine to me.
Yeah. Awesome.
And you were
better
good,
physical condition.
And therapeutically, you could handle our narcissistic asshole clients. You were great in the beginning before the seizure happened. Yeah. I think a whole third of the show was about build-ups to the seizure. Right. Oh, my God, they're at the dog park, and she's going to have a seizure.
No, the roller lights.
the ambulance, exactly.
Nothing. We just sit there. We held a blanket over her, and, it was fine.
It was a mixture of – it was really hot that day, so I was
you weren't at the Arroyo in Pasadena.
No, we were at the dog park near the Hollywood sign. Okay. I remember.
Yeah, that's what it was for sure.
Oh,
and so his whole episode got cut of promoting his organization.
Was it Heidi? Did Heidi have a seizure?
I don't know. Was it Heidi?
No,
Fries?
It wasn't Heidi. No,
was it normal
it was
people
group,
or celebrities?
Though, right?
It was that group. Yeah,
yeah.
Oh. It was normal people.
Normal people.
Oh, so it was what's her name?
Yeah, it was on the. It was after. Yeah. It was like you guys had transitioned.
Yeah,
from
we
celebrity.
Wanted to do one season of normal people because we were getting shit that it was all celebrities, and we did normal people. And nobody watched. Yeah.
Exactly.
So it told us. Oh yeah, really? We shouldn't have celebrities on it. Yeah, that's why you watch it,
thanks
idiots.
Thanks for watching.
That's how I dealt with my resentment. As I just said, well, no one's watching their show anyway because they're.
So now, what have you been doing in the 7 years? It must have grown. You have a passion for this. You got it in the prisons. You got a juvenile program. YA, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, we have been operating for the last almost 3 years, dog programs where basically 10 dogs will go inside the prison. They will live there in the housing unit, in the pod. We're the only program that's run out of a pod. Almost all educational all educational programs are run out of classrooms. So it's not – you're not in all of it. You're not on the yard. Everyone has this idea of what a prison yard is. That's where we are. That's where we do our training. That's where the dogs live. So the purpose of the – and we have them at California City Correctional Facility, Corcoran, North Kern, and Wasco. And when we're opening up at Tehachapi, which is a sense of needs facility. And then we have our first juvenile girls program.
That's YA, it's known as Youth Authority.
Youth Authority. Well, see, for girls, juvenile offender girls are the least advocated for group on planet Earth. People.
I'll bet.
The program.
Think about what he just said right there. We don't want to think about little girls committing crimes and being in gangs.
Nope. And you know what we give them? Home ec classes.
Oh,
you're kidding me.
What does that do for a cycle?
In prison, they have home economics.
They teach them how to be better.
That is 1954 at its best, Drew.
Yeah.
So what we've for that program in particular, which was Judge Brumfeld, who's a judge locally, I've been throwing this up against any person who works for prison who that will listen to me. And we've been able to find a few wardens and a bunch of people that have helped us drive it home. And she really said, you guys have to make this happen. Our girls deserve something. And these are repeat offender girls. They're called Pathways. So there's 23 girls who are repeat offenders between the ages of roughly 13 and 18. It's in a bizarre place. If you've never been to a kid's prison, there are kids.
I've been to the fire camp up in Crestline.
Yeah, there's a bunch of fire camps are different because they're open and they're dorm settings. And these are concrete cells that look just like big kid prison. And they're color coded. Kids will wear different outfits based on what their crimes are. And you'll have kids mopping porters that are wearing different stuff. And you'll have kids, you walk by their little hole, you look into their cell, and there's some 13-year-old who's by himself in a concrete cell pondering his life. Mm. And it's the same thing with the girls. And so what we're doing is the same thing. We're starting slow. We're bringing dogs in. We've been going there for almost a year in a therapeutic capacity.
Just bringing them in and then taking them out.
Having the girls we have a lot of very strong, wonderful girls. Angela Aiden is one of them. A bunch of girls, Lisa Porter, Leah Marquez, a bunch of really prominent, wonderful trainers. Angela lives at our rescue ranch in Tehachapi. And these girls are going to we're kind of a gathering as many positive, wonderful women as we can to be role models to these gals. Mm-hmm. But we go in to teach them a skill, and we go into – there's a big substance abuse program element to it. There's a big self-esteem element to it. And more than anything, you know, what you deal with in prison is being talked down to, being made to feel like you're less than. And we're there –
not even human.
Yeah, exactly. We're there to treat them with respect. We're there to grow with them. Mm. And that's why our programs are successful. And so I'm really excited about that program launching next week – or next month, excuse me. And then our big kid prisons have been remarkable. I mean, just the most remarkable. I knew bringing dogs into prison to live there would be therapeutic. I knew it would get guys who are in opposing gangs to work together. I knew it would bring down incidents, but I didn't realize we were going to start essentially, one of the training keys program, to reform in the penal system.
Mm-hmm. You should bring in some sort of academic group to study it so they can be published and sent out. And be
we're working through that. We have an assistant professor at Cal State University, Los Angeles, who's putting it – because you need data. Like you just said, you need data to show this stuff.
Yeah, have collected, it's called evidence-based.
Yeah, have them collect the data and send it up, but then other people will model it too.
Yeah. Which I don't mind. I want the world to have
that's right.
This.
Well, it's working. What the hell? And saving dogs. And come on. It's exactly. The best thing.
We have three. So let me ask you, 3 million incarcerated.
Let me ask you something, because I spent a lot of time in the penal institutions, both as a client and a owner. Yeah. You know, whatever they say, the hair club thing. Yeah. I've been a patient. Yeah, I've been a prisoner, and I've been a counselor.
Client,
and so I've been to Tehachapi. Mm-hmm. They're going to want pit bulls. Mm-hmm. And that is a big problem. They always do.
They always do, yeah.
Okay, so how do you get them to take a poodle?
you hand it to them and you watch what happens. We pair them based on their energies. We always pair them with another person of another
race.
Because
there's some dog breeders in there. There's some dog violent gang kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't think they've ever really looked at dogs. I think that it would be – because when you have a gang member in a place where they'll talk mm-hmm. about feelings and things, mm-hmm. you can have extraordinary conversations that I think that they've never dared have with anybody.
It is the most...
Right? Understand what I'm saying,
1,000%.
Right? And so you can say, listen, they're not just to fight. They're not just to look good in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And you put a poodle in their lap, and I'll bet you it's a profound experience.
Reversing that stigma or whatever preconceived notion they have in their mind goes away immediately. Well, almost immediately. All the tough guys want a pit bull. They all want – and then as soon as you give them whatever you give them, that bond happens almost instantaneously.
Right.
And they get very defensive. And then they – because they view themselves oftentimes as the misunderstood mutt, or they view themselves as a pit bull, the empathy starts to pour forth.
Well, you've
got to
be a pit bull coming
need.
From the trauma they come from. You've got to be a pit bull to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why they identify with that dog.
Well, do you tend to bring in the injured dogs too? And does that
we bring
help?
In everything. We've
does
had
the injured stuff help break it through?
Mm-hmm. We bring in a lot. So we have the dogs that live there, and then we'll bring in demo dogs. So we have a dog, Hooch, right, whose tongue was cut out. His ears were cut off.
He's
a
big, so it wouldn't bark?
Maybe. You know,
oh, my God.
He's an amazing dog. Again,
now, Drew, what do you do with a human being that would cut a dog's tongue out?
You know.
There are some that can't be.
So we bring those dogs in.
Stay away from them.
But the what you're looking for in prison is to fire on someone's empathy. You're looking for them to switch on their empathy.
Right.
You know, switch. And that's very difficult to do because they're in a place where they're not going to let their guard down anyway.
I always talk about their kids because most of them have kids. And when you talk about kids... Mm-hmm. You know, you break down that level of prisoner kind of thing. Well, anything to break it down.
Mm-hmm. The most wonderful thing that I've had happen, and it's happened probably 10 times, is because our positive change program is what it's called. It's so prominent on Instagram. Is we've had guys, most of our guys are violent offenders. They are 15 to life, almost all of them. And this is, we've rehabilitated almost 300 guys, right? Yeah. So only a handful have been out of prison. So all seven who have gotten out of prison
have
are
jobs.
Dog trainers. Mm. Remember that. Mm. But these guys have been away for so long, they're detached from their families. So one of my buddies, his name's Todd Olds, he showed me a letter that his daughter wrote him the day he got sentenced at Cal City. And it said, "You're no longer my dad." Mm. It had a picture of a really mean dog. And it said, you know, "Gary's now my dad," right? Mm. And he's the person, you know, essentially, "I don't want anything to do with you." After we started posting pictures of him, this is 9 years later, his daughter reaches out to him and says, "Daddy, I see the work that you're doing for these dogs. I see what you've done with the dog." Because the dogs have radical transitions. They transform in there because they're spending 13 hours a day with these guys. So his daughter, who he hasn't spoken to in 9 years, who's written him off, who's now 19, or 18, sees what your dad's doing, writes a letter to him and says, Daddy, I want you in my life for me. I want you because I deserve to have you in my life. And we've had 10 of those happen where kids now have relationships with their parents who are incarcerated because of the program, because they have something to be proud of them for. And wow. That's what it is. These guys need self-esteem. They need something to feel proud of. And this program makes them feel proud.
You know, it's interesting also because we have a political slant to this show sometimes. And one of the things that Drew and I can agree on, I coming from the left, him coming from the right, and trying to meet in the center.
I'm in the middle.
In the center. Listen. Yeah. This costs hardly nothing.
Yeah.
Compared to all the bullshit that they spend in prisons.
Imagine.
This costs hardly anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Well, by the way,
it costs nothing, and we raise all the money.
And it's saving cost for the animal organizations.
It costs $60,000 a year to incarcerate a person in the state of California. $60,000 on average. 86% of those men end up back in prison within 3 years. 86%. If you can prevent, if one guy that goes through our program just doesn't reoffend in a few years, the program pays for itself. Yeah. If he ends up out of prison for the rest of his life, it saves the state on average $3 million. Mm. You get that with a handful of, those are the numbers, but people don't want to listen. Those are the numbers.
Why do they not want to listen?
Because it's a culture. It is they don't know if they're in a roof or a rut or a groove. They're in a rut big time. But there has been a shift towards rehabilitation in the CDC, in the California Department of Corrections Rehabilitation. Yeah. They're starting to be held accountable. But, you know, we need to – now's the time we need to put the pressure on. And like Drew's right. You know, we have to have – it takes a long time to coalesce data. And I mean, we it's not even anecdotal. We know what our guys have done. We know that they're out here succeeding. And we know really what's important is – Tehachapi, for instance. It's one of the most violent prisons around because it's a sensitive needs facility. You know, and if we bring a program like this in, the violence between inmates goes radically down.
Do your guys go back in with the dogs?
They can.
The seven
some of
guys?
Them can. Yeah. Do so they? We just got clearance for Jason. He's only been out for 4 or 5 months. Had an incredibly successful dog training program in Orange County. He's been working with us, and they did. They gave us clearance for that, which is unbelievable. You know, because usually if you have a criminal record, we did bring one of our guys who we'd hired, who worked at our ranch, who did 13 years. He's a former, you know, former Tortilla Flat Crip. We brought him in. So he came in and demonstrated that he works at our ranch. And
what was it like for him going back in there like that? Must have been emotional.
That's what I'm wondering.
It was. Yeah. He was, it's funny. He stood back and he observed and he watched, and it was very surreal for him. I'm extremely, giving when I go in there, I have to be emotional. I have to hug. I hug everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he got comfortable with that because I'm having physical interaction with these guys. So that there, you really can't in our program. You can't feel standoffish. There's just not enough time to feel. It's too integrated. We're too emotionally involved. We love one another. The sounds, it's so inorganic, the concrete, the steel, the sounds of it, the way people look. It was very difficult for him. I'm very proud that he did that.
I'm
so our seizure patient, I'm remembering now, was Ashley.
Ashley
was the one, interestingly, I was so worried about because of her alcoholic liver disease.
Okay.
I was very concerned about
her
medically.
Did she really have liver disease?
Yeah. It was not what you're describing,
like
but
100 bottles of.
Yeah, she was drinking a lot. She was drinking a lot. But she had liver disease, and I was concerned it might not be reversible, but she's still doing good.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I try to work with as many transplant patients as I can, and they don't ever talk about diet. You know, so they'll keep you alive with, you know, they'll tell you not to eat red meat, or they'll tell you to stay off the salt. These kind of things that are so rudimentary in terms of the math of this is a simple subtraction and addition. We need to be working on complex trigonometry to get people to come back from diseases like this. You need to let them know that they need to live a high fiber diet. The carbohydrates, you know, turn into sugars, and they need to know all these things or they're going to die, mm-hmm. You know.
Drew's eating only bacon for the last 4
months. Not only bacon.
But that's another one, like eating ketogenically or eating, you know, high protein, high fat diets. Those are also things that they need to start working on in order to save these people's lives. We're throwing so much. You know how much it costs to put people on dialysis?
Oh, please.
I mean, and that's what the option
there's
is.
There's a proposition about it. Have you seen all the commercials?
Yeah, don't vote for it.
What are you voting? No on eight?
No on eight? Yeah. It will coalesce them all into these giant cooperatives. It'll be a mess.
And it already is.
It already is a mess. Yeah. But But
were you on dialysis?
No, thank God. But I was like this close. This Dr. Aziz, a miracle worker, came in and helped kind of stall my kidney failure. Because you know everything goes, man. When you're your pancreas, your gallbladder, your kidney, you know, everything.
Do you have a podcast? You should have a podcast.
I'm on one right now.
I know, but you should have your own.
I'd love to, man. My whole thing is I just had I have a child. I have a human child. I have a beautiful wife. These things that I get to I'm sitting with Dr. Drew and with Bob. Are you kidding me right now? You know what I'm saying? That these things are happening and it's unbelievable. So I would love to have a podcast.
You do have a Twitter. It's at Marley's Mutt.
I don't use the Twitter. I use Instagram and we use Facebook.
It's an Instagram, at Marley's Mutt. And there's a event coming up.
Yeah, we got an event in Bakersfield. It's called Paws and Pearls. It's kind of our black tie event where if you want to come to Bakersfield and listen to us talk about
Buck Owens.
The home of Buck Owens, baby. That's right. But I'm from Hermosa Beach. You know, I'm from down here. But that's our big event that's coming up. We've also expanded into Los Angeles. So Marley's Mutt is here. We have a couple of really wonderful fosters and even some celebrities are trying to help us get the word out. So we're in Los Angeles. We're expanding our prison program to this area. And it's really just having entree to get the conversations. I can sell positive change to anybody. We could get it into juvenile justice here. We could get it into the county system. People just need to be willing to listen.
Yeah, you're on the right track.
And be heard.
Just in general about dogs, like I have three dogs. And don't dogs just reflect their owners? Because you're calm and loving, and I'm neurotic and crazy. And my dogs just jump up, and they're you know.
Well, I'll tell you
how do you become a dog person that just – that dog has been in here for an hour and a half and not made one problem.
Yeah. And she just had both of her legs amputated 6 months ago. That's what I mean,
though. What was the reason for the amputations?
She came from the shelter with – she'd been hit by a car. Shattered front legs and
– just pain?
There was a bone infection in one of them. Oh, yeah, it didn't heal. And the other one was shattered in so many places it couldn't be saved. She's actually our fourth double front leg amputee. Oof. So we have several of them. But that's what they show you is it's very easy for me to get on my –
isn't it true that dogs are reflections of –
oh, absolutely. My dogs –
their parents, I said, of their owners, of their partners, whatever you want to call it, political correctness.
My dog Marley, who's this dude tattooed right here, he's the dog that helped me start at the namesake of the rescue. He was everything I always wanted to be. Confident, walked into a room, you know, and women wanted to be with him, men wanted to be like him. And my other dog, Tug, was just a neurotic nightmare.
Oh, really? So there's hope?
Nightmare. Totally. There's absolutely hope. You just have to, like, it's the two sides of you, right? You know,
right.
It's because there's a strong, confident guy in there in you for sure.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
But you know, it's balancing it out. But sorry.
A little bit.
But you know, it's certainly I've had some dogs that I shouldn't be fostering based on my mental on what I'm dealing with mentally.
Well, that's good to know. Then
for
it's
sure,
not just
man.
Me. Scooby-Doo is our rescue from Las Vegas, and it's Elvis, my son's dog, really. And I was just with her before I came here, and she's just jumping up, and it's embarrassing when other people around, like, they say down, and then down doesn't mean down. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Drew knows exactly what
I'm saying. I know what you're saying.
You know what my wife told me the other day, and just getting back to it.
How do you get dogs to not jump up on people and on?
Well, a lot of it is knowing when to give affection, you know, and also controlling your energy. Dogs don't.
Should you go right? I've had dog trainers. I hired a dog psychologist one time to come to my house back when I was a rock star in the 90s because it was very chic. So the guy said, go to the dog right away. As soon as you get home, go right to the dog and give it a lot of love and attention.
Did he suffer from codependence, this guy?
he was a dog psychologist.
Go to him right away.
When you come in the door, go right to the dog and make a thing all about the dog, and then it'll calm down and then it'll whatever. That's not what I found. When you go right to the dog, it's stirred up, and then it just stirs up more and more energy.
What I try and do is
I say hello, and then go do what you got to do.
It's all about association. So if they associate you at the door with excitability – so if you come home and get very excited, or if you leave and get very excited, they're just going to get excited every time you leave or come home.
Right.
It's about association, you know. Yeah. So
or you can have Rex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's just annoying, runs around circles and barks at everybody.
We get into all this nuance about like the potential about the canine human bond. Right? There's so much potential into it. Well, my wife told me today, like I had an awful morning, right? Just bad. And I've been going a million miles an hour trying to make Marley's Mutt succeed and Positive Change succeed and get in front of guys like you so I can share my story. And I also have a rescue pig from the Ojai fires. And I came home last night and she caught me basically spooning with the pig. And she's like, that, because the pig loves to be rubbed on his belly. Oh. That's what you're missing right now, Zach. You got away from that. Because it all went away, man. All the shit that was in my head that I was obsessing about. That I fall back into my old patterns.
Of course.
I fall back into my old patterns.
Right. Of course.
And these little, it's the easiest tool. Just allow yourself to receive unconditional reciprocal love from something. And then I had meditated. It was like I took a nap. I'm incapable of napping, you know? Right. So, but it was that simple magic is always there, and it's always there for us to tap into. And if you apply it to a therapeutic setting, you know, like we do at Juvenile Justice with the girls, these dogs will facilitate massive emotional growth. Massive. I mean, they will catapult people into a direction that they didn't know. People who are committed to being victim makers. People who have been victim makers their whole life have a new understanding of what empathy means, have a new understanding of what giving and receiving love means, all because of these dogs. And it's not something that us as people who are cerebral and want to like talk it out with these guys and really, it just happens as a byproduct of the interaction.
It's another facet of how to help. I'm big on cognitive behavioral therapy but I've become open to, because I work with this woman, Susie Randolfi, who runs the Wounded Warriors program. She does horses and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had always thought, the horse thing's just a gimmick for rehabs, right? Mm-hmm. No, I've seen – it doesn't work so good with drug addicts, mm-hmm. but it works with PTSD soldiers.
Yeah.
Because they know discipline and they know taking care of business. Yeah. You have to play so much catch-up with drug addicts trying to get them into the position mm-hmm. to have that. But dogs are much simpler than horses.
Yeah.
But dogs are right there with you. Yeah. I love this idea.
Yeah,
and I
absolutely.
Hope,
we just rescued our first horse from Lancaster Animal Shelter for that exact purpose. It's going to be a girls' work-to-ride program.
Oh, my gosh.
At the prison?
No, right. Oh. Our ranch backs up against the Hatchby prison. We share.
Oh, my gosh.
We basically share 3 acres with
anybody
the Hatchby
prison. Anybody ever escaped onto your property?
No. But the firing range is right next to so we hear every Wednesday, man. It sounds like World War III.
What is it like living in a town that the main industry is prison?
It's a Bruce Springsteen song, man.
Is it?
The cement plant and the prison. Those are like the aspirations of people that are there. You know, it's pretty interesting.
So, Drew, do the big sale so that everybody can go donate money. And
tell us where to
get
go.
To the events.
The best place, you know, there's a couple of things you guys can do. If you're an influencer, if you're on social media, you can wield your power extremely well. What we need is people to find out that we're doing this work. So go to at Marley's Mutts on Instagram. Go to at Positive Change Program on Instagram. Share us on social media. Put us in your story. Put us in your feed. Just show people what you're passionate about. If you like what we do, if you're into it, it speaks for itself. Just share it. If you want to make a donation, marleysmutts.org/donate. marleysmutts.org/donate. But people can really find purpose in their work on social media if they just, you know, mix in some altruism. You know what I mean? Mix in something that they're passionate about. And a lot of people are passionate about dogs and about criminal justice reform. So
very inspiring.
Share some of our stuff.
Marley's Mutts. There
you
it
should
is.
Hire
I'm
one of his
it.
Guys
I'm
to
following.
Come. Hire one of his guys to help train
your
dogs.
Dog. Absolutely, man.
Hire one of his guys to come train your dogs.
Yeah.
They're down here, man. And if you guys ever want dogs in for any reason, we have an entire 3 dozen dogs called our Miracle Mutts, which is our therapy wing. So these dogs are active all week long at our local facilities. We partner with 100 different nonprofits in Kern County. Our dogs are everywhere all the time, and these are certified therapy dogs that go around and just give love.
Oh, my God. Look at Franklin. He's waiting for his next amputation.
That's our other double front leg amputee.
Franklin?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Has he got a home?
Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks is fostering him.
Oh, is she? He has a home?
She's been a champ when it comes to fostering, man. She's really put up a lot. Not yet. He's got to have his next leg amputated on the 8th.
Schedule amputations like that. Everybody go to Marley's Mutts on Instagram. I'm watching all of
Marley's
it.
Mutts.
Oh, my God.
And then go to the
so
Positive
cool.
Change Program. Some of the interviews, guys, you know, graduation, you want to go to the happiest thing you could ever go to? Go to the Actors Gang. At Tashby Prison, which is a really good program, or go to Positive Change Graduation at a prison. When you see 40 guys graduating a dog program with all of their dogs and their loved ones who haven't had anything to be proud of for a long time, it is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thing.
That's so great. There's some positivity.
And also, man, you can find your purpose in recovery, man. You can absolutely find something that blows your hair back and that you can make a living doing, whether it's giving back or just Don't be afraid to find your passion, man. It's going to take some time.
Has the Marley's Mutts Paws and Pearls event coming up on November 3rd? Do you have an auction online?
It's got
a bid on auction items.
Yeah, there's a few things on there. We're getting better. We're getting better at it. We haven't had the infrastructure to hire but we have some volunteers that have been kicking butt, you know, pushing those things forward. So,
well, I hope everybody in the Bakersfield area goes.
With date with Bob?
Huh?
a date with Bob?
Oh, yeah, come down here and help me with my dog.
the right to train Bob's dog.
Well, I'm telling you.
The date with Bob.
We're going to get a new dog, too. Mm-hmm. Fourth is a charm.
Marley's Mutts.
I mean, if you want to be the coolest person,
one dog's going to come in and straighten the other dog's out.
That can theoretically happen.
We have coyotes, so my dogs have to have four legs. Unfortunately,
Well, think about adopting a dog that's been through Corcoran. If he can handle Corcoran, he can handle a couple coyotes.
What's
man, are you kidding me?
Corcoran
State
it's
Prison.
It's a prison, oh, wow. Susan. You know? She thought it was a restaurant.
You want to be the coolest person at the dog park. You have a dog that graduated a prison program.
Oh,
you know?
That's awesome.
And we have dogs from China in there. We have dogs from the meat trade. We have dogs from Thailand.
What's your thought about dogs sleeping in the bed?
All right. This is a tough one.
It's a really important thing.
When I'm on vacation, when I bring Cora with me for media
that
stuff,
dog sleeps wherever it wants because it's got two legs missing.
Correct. Yeah. Her poor me thing works every time.
Right.
Every time. But since
I'm talking about pit bulls on the bed.
I always used to. But now I have a wife and I have a baby. So
we have a chair.
We only let one dog is the answer. We only let one dog and it's probably unfair, but that's what happens. We let the small dog sleep in the bed.
I've never been a dogs in the bed guy.
Me neither.
And you don't have to be. That's perfectly fine. We still love you.
I mean, they can.
I think it tells them that it's not right. We got to go, but we're gonna get your stuff out. We're gonna put it on Dr. Drew's stuff. We're gonna get the message out about you guys. Thank you so much.
Great story. Thank you for sharing. I really appreciate it.
You got it, bud.
Great. See you next time.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC, being Lawrence Avon, 790 Midday Live Talk Radio, Monday to Friday. You can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Think What I Do By Myself, Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, at his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, Dairy W, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message. Join the email list at drdrew.com, drdrew.com/contact. You'll also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at drdrew.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.